Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in-depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. In this episode, I'm joined by University of Michigan professor Andy Markovitz to talk about his new book comparing the history of women's soccer in the U.S. and in Europe. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. Onward! Joining us now is one of my favorite regular podcast guests. He's Professor Andy Markovitz from the University of Michigan. Andy, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. One of my faves.
Yeah. You have a new book out. It's called Women in American Soccer and European Football, Different Roads to Shared Glory. I have read it. I really like it. I think it answers some questions that I've always had and didn't know about the history of women's soccer, which is obviously a big topic in 2019 with the Women's World Cup in France coming up starting in June. Why do you want to write this?
Because I've, as a political scientist and as a social scientist, have always been interested in outliers and in gate crashers and ultimately basically in democracy. And to me, democracy is a constant process, never-ending process of inclusion, of including the formerly excluded. And you know, my work has been on animal rescue and social democracy and new social movements. And then later on, of course, I started valorizing my big passion for sports, soccer in particular. And in the world of soccer, the world of soccer in some ways, certainly in the United States, is actually an outlier. And so that's actually also fits in very well with my overall life's project. But women on both sides of the Atlantic have been outliers and gate crashers. So I've been very interested in this. And the book concretely happened because of your encouragement. I have to say this. And we talked about the forthcoming World Cup in France, and then somehow got to talking about my chapter four in a book called Gaming the World, which was published by Princeton University Press in 2010. And so really spurred on by your encouragement, I decided to expand and update that chapter, which then became this little book. And I'm immensely pleased I did so.
Where can people get the book before I forget?
The book can be gotten on Amazon. It's actually the only place you can get it, and it's $7. I hate to do this sort of sales job here, but it's so it's actually very affordable, and you can get it both as a Kindle, which actually is cheaper still. I think it's $5.99, and the book itself, paperback, is $7.
Nice. There's some really interesting threads in the discussion here, and I find it fascinating to try and compare and contrast the development of women's soccer in different countries, because certainly in places like the U.S., Title IX played a huge role in giving women access in universities and colleges to playing sports on a much higher level, or at least with greater numbers. And Title IX didn't exist in other countries in Europe, but there are sort of also similarities in at least the timing of women's soccer's development in the 20th century between the U.S. and certain Northern European countries, especially where women's soccer was it existed in the early 20th century, then went through a period of not being recognized by federations, and then in the 70s, seemed to ramp up in different countries. Can you discuss a little bit of all that?
Yes, absolutely. I actually, again, from my earlier work, I actually argue that in some ways 1968 in particular, but the 60s, the late 60s, have created a hiatus, have created a shift in Western liberal democracies that has been unparalleled. In fact, I've often called it sort of the end of the Victorian era in terms of habitus, in terms of how people behave, in terms of what they dress, on and on and on. And interestingly, it also is very much the arena in which the second wave of feminism comes to the fore, and especially in the countries like the US and Canada and Northern Europe. And so it's not by chance at all that in the US, actually, it's the, basically legislation and really in some ways the courts, by virtue of the United States being a much more juridified country than its other sister liberal democracies, courts playing a much greater role and judicial review and so on, that in fact it is an act like Title IX that in fact propels this massive change. And that, in fact, it's in the spot of American colleges, which are absolutely indispensable in the creation of American sports, and in particular, in this case, also women's sports. And indeed, there is a bit of an homage in the book to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the famed Tar Heels, who have conquered 23 NCAA national titles, which is amazing, and in some ways, still better known for their legendary basketball acumen. Colleges play a very important role for propelling this social change in the United States. In Europe, it's actually also the women's movement, and which actually transforms, as you well say, the soccer's position. And it's not by chance that the era between 1970 and 1974 is absolutely decisive in Norway, in Sweden, in Denmark, in Germany, in England, and indeed also in the United States, where actually it's a two-phase process, I would say. The first phase is really from a complete marginalization and non-existence, basically so much so that, for example, in Germany, the DFB actually forbids women to play on its grounds between 1955 and 1970. The FA does the same actually already in 1921 and lifts it in 1970. So you see again this 1970 being a very important thing. And then the next step is actually the creation of sort of a intermediate stage, namely in the United States, the AIAW, Association of Intercollegiate Athletics for Women, and in Europe, the FIEFF, the Federation of Independent European Football, Female Football, excuse me, meaning that the women now start getting some institutionalization for their game, but it's still not part of the male dominant world. Meaning the NCAA, in this case, and of course FIFA. And so you have these sort of basically a decade of kind of already taking shape, but still outsiders. And then the great crashing actually succeeds, and by the early 80s, indeed, the AIAW actually becomes defunct, and as is, I think, the FIEFF, meaning then by the early 80s, women become formally emancipated in the world of soccer, meaning that they are now playing on the same field, which was not the case, meaning that they play same amount of time, maybe 90 minutes, which was also not the case, meaning that they play with the same ball, the studs, and that they in fact are formally accepted into these male domains. But I think what the book also shows is that emancipation is not equality. That in fact, still we have a long way to go there, that women have become emancipated in the world of soccer and indeed in many sports, but that in fact there still are not equal.
Yeah, I am struck also in reading this that you think it's not a coincidence that women's soccer has been slower to develop in some of the most traditional male-dominated soccer culture, some of the biggest men's soccer countries, Italy, Spain, Portugal, England to an extent, that's not a coincidence.
Not at all. Here is basically the story. Both of these women are on both sides of the Atlantic are pioneers and trailblazers, but the project is a tad different. In the United States, the women actually are in the forefront of creating the culture of soccer, meaning they are pioneers in creating this entity, which in fact was left or remained more or less empty by the dominant male hegemonic culture, which specialized in the big North American Big Four of American football, baseball, basketball, and hockey. To just use those four team sports, is of course a NASCAR, but on the whole, those four. So in other words, the American story is actually one of creating something from almost ex nihilo, out of nothing. And this is hard. This is hard stuff, but it's a different kind of hard. In Europe, the story is that the women actually had to not enter into empty space, but actually had to crash into arguably the most monstrous mountain that was completely dominated by men. And in fact, so their conquest or their entrance into this is a very different one. And both are very hard and differently hard. Kind of ostensibly, one would think that the Europeans had it harder because, of course, they're more demeaned, they're more challenged, they are kind of up against a much more formidable enemy, as it were, or someone that tries to keep them out. Whereas in the United States, the entry is a little easier because they are entering a space that to men is less important. And I think that the fact that the American option has parallels is not by chance. So typically, if you look at the strong sides in the women's game, it is the North Korea, it's South Korea, it's China, it's Japan, it's the Scandinavian countries, and arguably Australia, Canada, please, very important women's sides. But again, I hope the men will forgive me. They are not in the forefront of world football, and none of these countries are, including, by the way, the Scandinavians. Yes, the Swedes came in second in 1958 when they were hosts. Yes, they got the bronze medal in 1994 in the United States. Yes, the Danes were an amazing upset Euro champions in 1992, beating Germany. After they were on the beaches and Serbia was not allowed to play, so they were summoned from all over the place and actually unencumbered won the championship. I actually believe that this is a tremendous advantage playing unencumbered, but that's a different topic. And so the Danes actually did achieve that, but on the whole, I would argue that in these countries, the men never had the dominance, the cultural dominance of that they do in Germany, in England, in Italy, in all of Latin America, and so on and so forth. And so it's a different trajectory of coming to the fore here, and I would argue both very difficult, but on the whole also quite successful, above all on the national side. On the club side, that's a whole different story, but on the national team side, this is a very, very impressive achievement. And clearly the World Cup in coming in France will be a big event. People will talk about it, people will read about it, watch it, the players will become stars. I will never forget that the morning of that great game of US-Brazil, we actually, you and I saw each other in Dresden, and when, in fact, Megan Rapinoe, in the 123rd minute, an amazing cross, Abby Wambach, the header in. Hey, this was one of the great moments of my sporting life. Again, think about how when the women win the World Cup in 1991, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think virtually nobody welcomed them when they arrived at LAX, having just won the world.
Correct.
Yeah, the first FIFA World Championship, because there were earlier World Championships in 1969 and 1970. I mean, there were some earlier ones, but those are not recognized. And I was going to ask you about that.
But sorry to interrupt. I was going to ask you about those sort of earlier unofficial world championships, because the first FIFA Women's World Championship was 1991. But what happened with these earlier unofficial world championships?
Well, this is exactly the era, Grant, that I said, sort of the in-between. This is the AIAW. This is FIEFF. Basically, when women start... women are in organizations which are, however, not recognized by the dominant male world. So, in fact, in 1969 and 1970, there was a European championship, interestingly, in Italy. And both, actually, the Italian drink company Martini and Rossi play an important role. And fascinatingly, there's also an interesting Danish club called BK Femina. And Femina was a women's magazine, not a feminist magazine, but a women's magazine, which in the early 60s sponsored this football club. And then actually the sponsorship was given up, and the football club and the magazine remained completely apart. And it's this team that actually plays in Italy in 1969 for the European Championship, which it loses to the Italians, and in 1970 it beats the Italians in the World Championship. Again, very few play, and it's not recognized. Then in 1971, something very interesting happens, because there's another World Championship, in this case in Azteca in Mexico, and over 100,000 people go to this, which I found and actually researched. This is amazing. It was literally kind of a year after, of course, the Brazilian side won its treble, and the Coupe Jules Rimet was retired with them. And so this time Denmark actually beats Mexico 3-0, and actually a young Danish woman, I think by the age of 15, I forget her name now offhand, actually scores a hat trick. But these are sort of not events, but they are not really recognized as official parts of the game. And as you well know, few sports are as Catholicly organized, meaning with a clear pope and a clear pyramids, as world football. And if you are not in the church, you are not in it. You are excommunicated. So all these odd world championships that I recount in the book and just mentioned are really for naught and non-existent. So the first one is indeed the 1991, the Michelle Akers et al. Championship in China. And that's the one. And on the national level, it's actually phenomenal. When you think about it, actually, the American team, it's insane. I mean, the American team has literally won of the seven World Cup and six Olympic tournaments. It has won actually every single time. Has won some medal, with the exception of the last Olympic games. I mean, this dominance is amazing, and I think really bespeaks a phenomenon, not only a great achievement, but also soccer's position in many ways in the United States, which is a little different, and meaning it's also less salient, which means it's less fraught with hatred, with all kinds of other things, fewer obstacles than the equivalent is the case in the other countries where, however, on the national level, they're starting to be accepted for the simple reason that this is actually a national pride. So the English, the England team in the last World Cup suddenly became a huge success story because they were superb. They actually beat the Germans for the first time in 20 tries. And they beat the Germans that the men actually don't do so often. For the English to beat German in anything is a big deal. And the women's national team, also in Germany, has attained some significance, cultural significance, so much so that the World Cup will be an event. This has not parlayed into the club side. So club and country on the women's side is still solely country, with one amazing exception, which are the Portland Thorns. I must say, I have to go there this summer. I actually had a chance.
Yeah.
I had a chance to see the Timbers, but I've never seen the Thorns. And when I did this research, I mean, they have 17,000 spectators, never less than 13. This is insane. I mean, most other women's teams in Germany are around 1,000, 1,200, sometimes actually under 1,000, the same in England, even though they're actually supported, some of them at least, of the Super League are in fact are part of their much more important men's teams, which I think also has some problems, but that's a different story. It's the attendance is nothing or virtually nothing. And in Portland has become, I think, the women's soccer city in the world. I mean, it's the soccer capital, as it were.
Yeah, and I think, maybe Lyon in France might be the only one that's close to it.
But I don't think
at this point.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but I think it's regular attendance is still way lower. It's not.
Yeah. It is.
That's exactly. So I mean, it's higher than the rest of Europe, including such great sides as Turbine Potsdam and FF1 Frankfurt and. And again, we're talking about, in some ways, a kind of marginalization. For example, in German, it's always, the game is always there is always the sobriquet of Frauen, Fußball, that already means it's somehow different. With the men, it's never called men of Fußball, it's just Fußball. And that is a very, very tall mountain to climb. For the Europeans.
Going back a little bit here, we talked about the unofficial world championships on the women's side that took place. What actually caused FIFA to get its act together and finally start organizing a true women's world championship? First one in 1991, which wasn't even called at the time a women's world cup. It was like the Women's World Championship for the M&M's Cup, and they retroactively called it Women's World Cup later on. Why had FIFA finally at that point organized this?
It's called a delay. It's a culture, it's basically the pressure societally in these countries really led to the fact that this was a new force that you just could not accept this. I'm sure I wish I were a fly on the wall, but I'm sure with immense derision, I'm sure with immense contempt, with not seeing it in any way as authentic, but ultimately something in the public domain of these liberal democracies demanded that women be given, that women be emancipated, formally equal. And even FIFA could not get around that. And so ultimately, it's a form of, these institutions respond, are sort of, to me, institutions in general, nothing to do with sports, are really in some ways mirrors of societal developments. And that's why I'm actually much more of a sociologist than a political scientist, because in some ways they have to reflect this, at least in sort of democratic entities. And FIFA just, just could not delay this any longer. I'm sure it also played a role that, it was potentially lucrative. After all, it included, for the first time, China. This was literally a year and a half to two years after Tiananmen Square, when the Chinese put down, or the very brutally, the student rebellion, and China for a brief while is sort of a bit of a persona non grata internationally. And so obviously organizing this event was important. So I'm sure that this was not done with enthusiasm. We know all the resistance later and suggestions about women playing in tight shorts and all this stuff. But ultimately, institutions have to react. And they do so slowly, but they do. So FIFA, again, I'm not privy to any internal decisions of what in fact happened in the late 80s, why this happened, but clearly, the Norwegian woman Espelund, I forget her first name offhand, who is a very important leader. Karen Espelund, thank you. Who is a very important player in Norway. And again, by the way, not by chance, it's Norway, the men's game is not very strong. Plus, in the northern countries, obviously, there's something called social democracy, which, and an extensive welfare state and a very egalitarian culture and all of this, which really propels women into the ranks of almost equals in the world of association football. And Karen Espelund, thank you, I'm sure played an important role. She, after all, becomes a major player in the Norwegian Football Federation, the first woman, and she then becomes also internationally important. So, the gates ultimately crash, and it takes a while. A lot of corrosion, but everything crumbles.
So based on the research you've done for this project, both in the US and in Europe, is it possible for you to sort of see the path that women's soccer has taken over the last few decades and in any way predict how this might continue to grow or spread to other countries around the world?
Yes, I think. I think that we already see clearly some bleeding, if you will, sort of a kind of expanding into countries that have been immensely resistant. So, for example, Latin American countries, where Argentina is now picking it up. And I mean, Brazil had the great players, but so obviously institutions change. And so I would say that on the national side, on the countryside, to use soccer language, on the countryside, I think this is already on a very fine trajectory, meaning the World Cup will become bigger still. It's a big event. It will be broadcast. It's a big cult. It's a big issue, it will be it can't be hushed up anymore. It's not quite as big as the Olympics, and of course nowhere near that of the Men's World Cup, but it's a big deal. Now, on the club side, this is a very, very different story. And here, personally, I'm still worried. I just don't quite see, other than in the United States, by the way, because the clubs are called colleges. Other than in the United States, but here too, of course, colleges still don't have a huge attendance, but I think it's on the club side where I kind of worry or don't see actually through my research any kind of translation of the national or the countryside in the women's game. But ultimately, maybe that need not be the case. In other words, maybe, in fact, look at the Algarve Cup. The Algarve Cup actually is an annual event, which is a very big deal, but it's of clearly four national sides or country teams, where the best, 12 and then 8 participate. And it's a big deal, but of course it is that important because the clubs are less of a deal. Right. So I just don't... look, for example, I'm kind of distraught by the fact that the women's cup final in Germany, now actually decoupled from the men's in Berlin, which I thought was a good thing, now being played in Cologne, but the attendances have gone down. I don't quite... the whole thing about clubs is a form of... basically tribalism. Some of it actually very ugly and very nasty. And a student of mine just emailed me literally 10 minutes before I started talking to you from arriving in Heathrow Airport, in which in one of the lounges it says no football shirts allowed. Meaning, and she asked me, yes. And she says, why? And I probably surmised because, they don't want any fights, in this lounge. So that actually is very much part of club identity. And this, of course, takes 100 years. And so I just cannot see, but, maybe actually I'm just not imaginative enough, but I cannot see the translation of affect into the club world, because into the national side it's much easier. We are all Americans, or you're all Germans, or it's the national anthem and all of this stuff. And so basically it's very easy to translate a passion, an emotion, onto the national side, where women actually now excel and people will follow it and really are rooting for the United States or Japan or whatever. And it's very clear what you're rooting for. But on the club side, it's very hard to translate that into a passion that the men's side has had for 100 years. Doesn't mean it's impossible. I have no idea. But it will take a much longer way for it to happen.
Well, you might get that invitation, Andy, to come out and watch a game for the Portland Thorns with the Riveters, their fan club out there. I think they'd love to have you.
I'd be honored. I'd pay my own way. I'd love to. Are you kidding me? No, I'm serious, because it's unique. I mean, I've never, when I did the research, I actually did a double or triple take when I saw these numbers, because I thought they're actually wrong, and they weren't wrong compared to the other numbers, including, by the way, of course, even in the United States.
The book is Women in American Soccer and European Football, Different Roads to Shared Glory. You can get it on Amazon. Andy Markovitz, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Andy Markovitz, as well as everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. That's it for this week. See you next time.